Hi, I'm David Teasdale. This is CJMQ 88.9 FM, and I'm really delighted to have with us today Diana Davison. And Diana, I've watched a lot of your videos. I don't remember seeing one in which you actually described yourself. So would you mind, you know, just giving us a little description of what you do and how you came into all of this?
Right, yeah, I guess that's true. I try not to talk about myself too much on the videos and just focus on the issues at hand. And part of that is that I think that everybody, no matter who you are, should take an interest in what's going on with our legal system. So I don't really talk about myself too much, except for the fact that I'm now running a nonprofit. It's called the Lighthouse Project. And we help the falsely accused and wrongfully convicted now to put their evidence together and try to see that justice is done properly in the courts. And it's an uphill battle because of all the changes that are taking place. And one of the things I want to talk to today is a proposed change called Bill C-51.
Oh, yes, I was just reading about that.
It's an interesting bill because she's put a whole bunch of stuff together all into one package. And I think it's a little bit deceptive to do that because some of the stuff that she's proposing, and I'll kind of go through it a bit, but some of the stuff she's proposing is pretty obvious and fairly straightforward, and yet she's intermixed with it a bunch of proposals to change sexual assault laws, which are, as one lawyer has said, catastrophic in terms of due process rights.
Now, who's proposing this?
So this was proposed by the Minister of Justice, Jody Wilson-Raybould, and it was announced in the papers in June 6th of 2017.
Mm-hmm.
And overall, the media reports were, finally, Canada's catching up to modern times in our sexual assault laws. And it was promoted as a really good thing in terms of getting justice for victims.
Yeah.
A lot of that rhetoric find around discussion about sexual assault is we talk about justice for victims. And it goes hand in hand with this sort of Twitter phenomenon, hashtag believe.
Oh, yes.
That we should hashtag believe people who claim that they've been sexually assaulted.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand the sentiment because it's really important to be a good support person, especially, you know, assuming it's true, this person has gone through something fairly traumatic. And so you want to be supportive, but in a court of law, hashtag believe just doesn't work. It violates every principle of the legal system.
Well, it's an automatic presumption that the person who is accused is guilty.
Exactly. It's a reversal of the presumption of innocence. And the way some of these laws are being applied, it's also reversing the burden of proof. So essentially, the guys I'm helping, as much as we shouldn't be saying it this way, we have to go in there with evidence of innocence in order to assure that they're acquitted.
So you're having to prove that people are innocent rather than the other way around, someone having to prove that they're guilty.
Right, that's what it's coming down to. And so this bill, it has some really fun stuff in there, like taking out old laws, things like fraudulently claiming that you're performing witchcraft or challenging somebody to a duel, sort of archaic things that we don't really need to bother ourselves with anymore. And so they want to remove that stuff. And it's an interesting thing that happens is, you know, we also have laws that are deemed to be a violation of our rights, and so judges strike them down, and they don't actually get removed from the criminal code. So it's kind of a cleanup bill, in part, right? A significant portion of it. And yes, that stuff should be done. But mixed in with that is a change to evidence rules in sexual assault trials. And a lot of people believe, and I agree with them, that this is a reaction to the Gian Gomeshi trial, which, you know, lots of people were paying attention to, lots of people wanted to see him convicted. But when the evidence came out in court, it turned out that all three of the accusers were lying and he was rightfully acquitted. So you would think the reaction to that trial would be, wow, let's make sure our justice system keeps working. Thank goodness he was allowed to bring this evidence into court.
Yeah.
But the reverse is happening. They're saying, what can we do to stop evidence that the women have lied? And there's some legitimate reasons to block certain types of arguments, right? It's called the twin myth. And the twin myth is basically that evidence or discussion of a woman's prior sexual activity or promiscuousness would deem her less credible in court or would you know, presume that she's more likely to have consented. And those are myths. They're called the twin myths. And there's an evidentiary hearing section, which is designed to try and prevent that type of harassment. It really is harassment of the complainant in the courtroom.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called Section 276. And what Bill C-51 would do is add to Section 276 the types of things that they would have to have a preliminary or in-camera hearing over before they could introduce it into the courtroom. And there's more that's changing about it as well. And it's kind of being written off as like, well, this isn't a big deal because we already have some of these hearings. What they have to do is say, I'm planning on asking this line of questioning, and this is what purpose is. And so then the judge will decide if they're going to allow it. And quite often, if they do allow it, it'll just be in part. And whenever that area of questioning comes up in the trial, then the judge is being pretty careful to limit how much that evidence is used. And what they want to add to it is that any evidence in the possession of the accused, like text messages, emails, and video, anything of an electronic nature, that all of those things would have to be vetted in advance of the trial as well.
Also, the things like in the Gomeshi case.
Exactly. And I don't think it's an accident that it pretty much describes everything that came out in evidence in the Gomeshi trial.
Huh.
And then people say, well, that's not a big deal because obviously those things were relevant, so they would have been allowed, right?
Yeah.
But it violates another principle. There's not another single type of trial in Canada or, you know, accusations or charges that you can face in which the defense has to give their evidence over to the Crown, the prosecutor, in advance. And so they don't have to reveal their defense strategy.
Not even murder?
No. The defense doesn't have to give the Crown any evidence. And the reason is because the imbalance of power and resources. So the Crown prosecutor has the resources of the state pretty much endless. And the individual only has what their bankroll can afford, which, you know, people complain with celebrities and stuff, well, they've got so much money, they're just going to buy their way out of this. It doesn't really work that way. But the majority of people going into court have very limited resources. And sometimes it's just like a legal aid attorney who's defending them, somebody who's not all that experienced necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever they do have working for them, to kind of balance the scales, don't have to expose what their case is in advance. And except for now, if this goes through on sexual assault cases, and what makes it even worse is that with sexual assault complainants, no matter what they did, no matter what email they wrote or how incongruous their behavior was with the claim that they were assaulted, well, we've got experts that they're bringing in to explain that away.
Oh,
saying
yes.
Basically, if you combine those two things together, that the defense has to tell them all of their evidence, then it allows the complainant to change their story around the evidence.
And also, there doesn't seem to be any repercussions to someone making a false accusation.
That's another problem. I mean, there's a couple of reasons why you wouldn't just want to prosecute anybody if it appeared that they were lying. Because, for one, some women become convinced that they were assaulted, even if evidence shows that they hadn't been. And in one of the cases I came across, they actually had video that showed the time that the gentleman had entered a building and the time that he left, and it was within 5 minutes. So her story can't have happened, right? So take a case like that. And the woman was in shock because in her mind, in her memory, she thought that it happened. She actually truly believed it. So she wasn't actually making a false complaint, even though we know definitively that it didn't happen.
Wow.
So there's that. And then you also have to keep in mind that there is a burden of proof that then reverses. So if you're going to accuse somebody of having engaged in public mischief, making false statements to police, perjury, lying under oath, that you can only go forward with cases where you actually have proof that they did that and that they knowingly did it, I believe, with malice. So
if we take the principle of believe them, then everything would be coming to court.
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the problems that you'll see when you look at a lot of the rhetoric, especially from the advocates, that they start talking about numbers, right?
Yes.
And without getting into all the complications with how their numbers are speculative, right?
Mm-hmm.
That their focus on numbers implies to me, and I think it should imply to everybody, that they're not interested in the actual facts of the case, individual cases. They want numbers, and they won't be satisfied until the number of men who go to jail accused of rape match the numbers that they believe are probably guilty.
Oh, yes, they're famous numbers that something like only 2% of rapists actually get convicted or something like that.
Yeah, I think it's, they usually say 6 or 7 out of 1,000.
Yeah, okay.
I read a really interesting comment in an article, actually, that says, all we know, if you were to believe those numbers are true, that 7 out of 1,000 people accused of rape get convicted, then all we really know is that 7 rapists got convicted.
Yeah.
We don't know how many non-rapists didn't get convicted, right?
Yeah, you know, it's a pretty scary concept. As a guy, I find it very scary to think that anybody, any man really could really have his life ruined tomorrow morning by a false accusation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. And that's the thing, is a lot of the people I'm helping, they're just in shock because they thought, as a lot of people do, that if somebody's been accused of something, they probably did something, right?
Yeah, that's a problem.
Kind of the where there's smoke, there's fire. And then mm-hmm. all of a sudden, it's happened to them. It's happened to their son, to their husband, or, a family member or friend.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, they say, oh, my God, this actually can happen to anyone.
That's a present-day situation. That's right now that exists. It has existed for all along, that any man accused is automatically considered guilty, and his life is automatically ruined. What's changing now with this law, if I understand you, is that him making an effort to prove himself innocent is going to be much more difficult.
Oh, yeah. It's getting into the near impossible, actually. When you combine this, like, they could bar pretty much any evidence you have. And I've seen this argued in court that, and actually it was a really big case. It makes a really good example. One, if people have heard about the whole Robin Camp fiasco where the judge was, going to be removed from the bench. He didn't retire.
Oh, yeah.
He was referred to as the keep your knees together judge.
And yes.
Which was, by the way, taken very much out of context. The prosecutor in both the original and the retrial, which thankfully he was acquitted on the retrial as well, tried to bar a witness testimony who, the only reason these two people were alone in the bathroom where these events took place was because the complainant told the girl, yes, I'm going to have sex with him. And so she left them alone in the room. And the prosecutor tried to say, well, that's irrelevant because as soon as the door closed, that person doesn't know what happened.
Yeah, it's a very slippery slope. Very slippery.
We're talking evidence right up into the second before, and any evidence that happened a second after. So they're just putting it down to a little narrow box of time in which only two people were present. And they're allowing this to go to court with nothing but the complainant's testimony. No evidence required anymore.
It's very scary.
I don't know how you meet the burden of proof.
It's very, very scary, and it should be very scary to men, but also anyone who has men in their life that they care about, their sons, their fathers, their uncles, their brothers, any males in the family that that they care even a little bit about, they should be very concerned about situations like this.
Mm-hmm. And not just how to get through the trial, which is becoming more and more impossible, but the moment you're accused. I mean, this idea that we live in a rape culture where, people don't take rape seriously, the moment you're accused of a sexual assault, your life is practically ruined. And there's a really big misunderstanding out there, in part fed by, this feminist rhetoric that nothing happens to people because we live in a rape culture, right? That very few people get convicted. Nobody seems to care about it. So people can make these accusations believing that nothing will happen to the guy. It makes it a lot easier to make a false allegation if you think nothing bad's going to happen to him.
Well, going back to the John Comeshi case, the people who were accusing him knew full well they were ruining his life, as far as I know. They seem to know. They seem to have very good comprehension of what would happen to him.
And we had many exchanges between two of the complainants in which they were basically calling him, feces and saying it's time to flush, and that they were maliciously trying to destroy him.
Well,
but the weird thing was, Lucy DeCater actually said in an interview, oh, you know, jail's not going to change, Gian. You know, it's just like your life stops and then it starts again.
Wow. Very callous, don't you think?
And it shows no understanding of how traumatizing it is. Even, you know, guys I've met who've been thrown in jail for a few days or, you know, a few weeks before they were able to get on bail or something, they're traumatized from that. Like the moment you're told that you're charged with something, it's traumatizing.
Oh, of course, yeah. But as far as I...
part of what I have to do, too, is get them into a space where, like, they're not just... They're just kind of floating around. They can't even understand what happened or how to explain it or where to start to try and explain the story. And so, of course, you can picture the state they're in, and then they have to also try and find a lawyer and explain to the lawyer their evidence is. So helping them to focus and get a sense of stability again so they can actually start looking for the evidence that they to go to court with. It's a big part of the job that I do.
Well, it must be horribly traumatizing, even just to be falsely accused is the internal feelings that go with that. When you know you're innocent and someone is just accusing you of something, but when you're accused of something as horrific as rape or sexual assault, that hits, and then to actually be arrested and incarcerated for that, I can't imagine what these people go through. So you're involved, and I'll have to just give a little bit of background, how I came across your videos on YouTube, and I very quickly realized that you do a lot of research. And you come up with a lot of information that other people otherwise miss. So what you're saying is not to be dismissed just offhand. You've been proven right many times. So
far, yeah.
Yeah, but in a sad situation. But I recently became aware of your involvement with, as you mentioned, the Lighthouse Project, which is trying to help people who have been falsely accused to be able to get some, at least some of their life back. Is that right?
That's right. So we help them prepare for trial and then support them in court wherever possible. Of course, I'm helping people from all over Canada as well as some people in the U.S., so I can't always be actually in court with them. And if things go well and they get acquitted, then, yeah, I stick with them and help them to rebuild their life again and move forward. What you were talking about, that, you know, the trauma and the shock, what we were talking about, I call that, it's kind of like an existential crisis, which is one of the factors that these guys are dealing with, especially if their case is in the newspapers or if their accuser is going on social media and telling everybody about their accusations.
Mm-hmm.
That for them, they know who they are and they know what actually happened. And yet somebody else is able to completely rewrite their identity.
Wow, that's true.
Through the media. It's a really bizarre thing, and it's really difficult, too, because, you know, lawyers are right that it's better for them not to make public statements. If they feel like they want to make a statement, they should do it through their lawyer. So they're sitting there, voiceless and helpless, and watching somebody else, you know, call them all these terrible things and paint them as a monster.
Yeah, there's a lot of that goes on, and it must be very, very difficult for them to, as you say, have their life reframed over something that they never did. And one question that comes to mind, though, is how do you choose the people that you're supporting? How do you choose the ones that are not guilty as opposed to guilty? How do you make that justification? How do you figure that out?
Well, I mean, in reality, in a courtroom, then you should just presume innocence, but obviously I'm not doing that. Because my resources are really low, I mean, one of the things I should mention and make clear, too, is that we don't charge the people that we're helping anything for our service. Everything we do is all crowdfunded by people who've come to realize that this could happen to anyone or it has happened to them themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And then hopefully when they get in a better place, they can go and donate to help other people out. But we don't actually charge anybody that we're helping. And because it's limited resources right now, it's essentially just me trying to work on all the cases with a few helpers and the co-founders. But it's mostly just me, so I can't help everybody who contacts me. I have actually turned a few people away who I just didn't think that I believed them.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But the standard I use, is not just as, you know, even a balance of probabilities. I focus on the ones where I've essentially got evidence of innocence.
Okay.
Right. So I'll work with some people And then if I feel like they're not being completely open and honest with me, then I'll just kind of say, you know, get back to me when you're ready to talk, right?
Okay.
But for the people, as we go through these different phases, and I can help them get focused, and I usually, I ask first, what did you get accused of? I want to hear the accusation first.
Huh.
And then I ask them what actually happened. And by going in that reverse order, right, by hearing the accusation first, I can actually start to see, well, if this person is lying, then this is where we're probably going to find some evidence, and it kind of speeds up the process of figuring out where to look. But yeah, the cases where I follow through in full advocacy and try to be in court with them and stuff are cases where I'm like 99.9% sure this person is innocent. I've got compelling evidence.
Okay, and what do you say about the claim of some people that women don't lie about rape, and that a very, very small number of rape allegations are false?
Well, the reality is that women are human, and humans do lie, right? There's nothing that makes women different than men in terms of that capability. And our justice system is designed to presume innocence, and it's nothing personal against women or about the nature of the accusation, that we need to do proper investigations. We need to only charge people where there's a reasonable prospect of conviction. And that's not a personal statement on them. It's just our system is designed to prevent wrongful convictions, and it has to follow that path. But an interesting thing about, you know, what people say about women, right? A lot of these experts that go into the courtroom or fill up social media with all of their theories on why women sometimes do strange things, like send love letters to a person the day after they've supposedly been assaulted and so on, right? They have an excuse for all of that. As it turns out, like a lot of these studies, they're doing things like comparing women to dogs. The current theories about rape theory trauma are an extension of battered woman syndrome. And battered woman syndrome, the main theory about why women would kill a man instead of just walking out the door when they're sleeping, is based on a study of dogs saying that, you know, they had shocked a bunch of dogs at random times, and the took on a defeated, learned helplessness is what they call it, and it would stop trying to escape. Right? And, you know, this has pretty much been debunked, although unfortunately all of these, you know, expert witnesses continue on. As we know, women aren't like dogs, right? Their brains function differently. We're capable of, you know, much more creative thought, I would say. You know, there's lots of dog lovers who might disagree with me. But then I just came across another one, a rape trauma expert, who, again, said most of what she learned from her dog, Sophie. Oh, and she has a picture of her dog lying on its back with its legs out and its belly spread, snoring away on her couch.
A pug.
And then a little pug. And then she switches to a picture of a woman who's passed out in an alleyway with her legs splayed all over and tries to say that this is the same thing.
Yeah, I actually saw that, and I found it really a strange kind of comparison to make, and a real stretch.
Well, I've, you know, as you said, done a lot of research. And when you look into the theory, and I have no fear that if I announce this, they'll go and they'll change this and try to hide their work, because you can't become an expert witness unless you've got a published body of work, that every single one of them, you'll find these outrageous claims and comparisons and utter nonsense that debunks them. And in fact, with battered women, the groundbreaking case in Canada that allowed battered woman syndrome, that's not a defense. It's basically to bolster a claim of self-defense. But the first battered woman syndrome case where testimony in it was allowed, there's this Dr. Fred Sheen who testified in a case called R versus Lavallee. And it was Angelique Lavallee. And so that was a big case for him, and they had a big name and stuff. But I've come across other transcripts where a judge has said, yes, Dr. Sheen, I've heard what you have to say. And you say the same thing every time. And it was true. He goes into the courtrooms and says pretty much the same thing about every woman after having met with them for an hour, maybe a couple of hours. Why they allow this in court, I have no idea.
And these people are paid for their opinion, right?
Highly paid.
Yeah, okay, that's why. The explanation's there to follow the money. I'm curious about why you got involved in this and what motivates you. I'm just really curious as what got you started with this.
Well, I've always loved the law since I was a teenager. I actually considered getting into the law for a bit, becoming a lawyer. And then I was thinking, well, I don't think it's as glamorous as you imagine from watching the movies and stuff, that you don't really get to choose your clients. And of course, a lot of lawyers end up just doing like corporate law or paper pushing and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went on and did something a little more artistic. But I've always been fascinated with the design of the legal system, the philosophies behind it, the complexity of, like, the beauty of what we've built, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when you look back in history at the, witch trials and so on, and to have that as a comparison, we really have built something beautiful. It's not perfect, but it's amazing. And so as I started getting contacted by these people who were reaching out desperately trying to find help, and got more and more calls coming in of people who'd been falsely accused, then it just kind of naturally led into that. And for whatever reason, I'm just really good at breaking down the accusations and finding the lies in it that we can try and prove.
Yeah, well, I was really trying to find, because I read a while back, and too long back from my memory, some information that was really quite pertinent that you had come up with. I was quite impressed by that. You really did your research on that. But why with the with males? Why helping men? Because I find there's an inordinate number of women who are trying to help men, and men are more afraid to speak up for themselves. I think that there would be more men speaking, like Paul Alem would, if there was more like him. But mostly it's falling to women to come to the defense of men.
Yeah, well, I mean, we live in strange times where, like, epithets are thrown around and result in, the silliest things are resulting in people losing their careers,
Mm-hmm.
Like now, apparently everybody's a Nazi,
Yes.
And everything's a misogynist. I'm a misogynist. I'm a self-hating woman, right?
Well,
but,
the
labels don't stick so much on women. And
that's it.
It's like they can get away with it, where guys are afraid to say, well, that just sounds like a bunch of nonsense. They'll get attacked for it and suffer consequences in their employment. If they own their own business, they'll get boycotted. Just look at the journalists over a different issue, but the number of journalists who had to quit or resign or been fired for cultural appropriation.
Oh, yes.
Comments.
Mm-hmm. It does resemble a lot of the witch hunts, and I know that as a guy, I have a hard time saying much of anything. I've test piloted it a little bit. I've spoken to some people, and right away a guy is shut down because the claim of misogyny. But saying something in defense of men is not saying something against women, and really nothing that's being said is against women. What it's against is radical feminism, or, as you described so well, the changes to our laws, which are going to disproportionately harm men.
Mm-hmm. And I do actually define myself as a civil rights activist, because you can speak about these issues of what's going on in the sexual assault trials without having to enter into a gender debate. What you're talking about is your civil rights, your right to due process, your right to a fair trial, and your right to be presumed innocent, that the burden of proof remain on the state. And people need to understand those principles. I'm actually looking to do an educational series on it, because you look at the signs that protesters are marching around with right now, what is clear is that they don't understand the principles of the legal system, primarily the burden of proof, presumption of innocence, and why we have the standard of reasonable doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And if they understand those, I think that about 90% of those signs would just disappear.
What kind of signs are you referring to?
Oh, the hashtag believe, and that prior to any verdict in a trial, they're saying that the guy's guilty, and
mm-hmm.
They shouldn't be looking at the complainant. They should be only talking about the accused, and of course it's always seen as the guilty guy who's sitting in the accused box.
Yeah.
So it's important right now with the amount of attention that people are putting onto these trials. You can see tons of attention on it with the Gian Gomeshi case, with the Robin Camp knees together thing, the drunks can consent Judge Linehan from the East Coast, who's a very good judge, and then this whole Unfounded series that was in the Globe and Mail that's demanding numbers again. They're talking as if we know numbers, and that if the police's numbers don't match their numbers, if they believe there's only 2 to 8% of false accusations, so if more than 8% is unfounded, then apparently that police station needs to reform itself.
Oh, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, get their numbers up. It's like going out and getting a ticket, except this one ruins a person's life and a whole family's life. I mean, men aren't living in isolation. They have people who depend on them, people who love them and care for them. So it's very, very difficult. Just want to remind everyone we're talking with Diana Davison. And I'm not talking about here, we're not talking about law in some strange country. We're talking about what happens in Canada. And I don't think people realize that freedom of speech and proven innocent until proven guilty is disappearing very rapidly here in Canada.
You'd think it was another country, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm very disappointed. I don't know. Disappointed is the mildest word I can come up with the changes that are going on. I've listened to Professor Peterson.
Great.
Yes, just incredible. The talks that he gives describing what is going on with freedom of speech, compelled speech, right here in Canada. So we're talking about Professor Peterson. I believe he's in Toronto, the
University of Toronto, yeah.
Yeah, and there's Janice Fiammingo at the University of Ottawa. There's yourself, and you're in British Columbia. Lauren Southern, another Canadian who's speaking about Canadian laws and changes. And, of course, Karen Strawn. All these voices being raised to talk about...
Holding the fort out in Alberta is Karen Strawn.
Yeah, in the forgotten province.
They've got big troubles out there, too. They had, like, four judges in their review just for, like, a single sentence that wasn't, you know, that they said was problematic in their judgment. They'd toss out the whole verdict just because they didn't like one sentence. Four judges in Alberta all in one time. So, yeah, Karen's got to stay in Alberta and keep working from there.
Yeah, so the project that you're working on, how can people help with that?
Well, we have a Patreon. It's Patreon/Lighthouse. And so if people want to donate to help us, help other people, that's the best way to do it. And Patreon, because we can actually get like a solid income per month that we can, you know, mostly count on, which currently allows me to do this full time. And we're trying to get so that there's another me. We can have a second person who's doing it full time to handle the caseload of what's coming in.
Okay, we're talking about helping people who have been falsely accused to get through the system and actually get part of their life back, the work that you're doing. And the people can help through Patreon dot what?
That's, patreon.com/lighthouse.
Slash what? Excuse me?
Lighthouse. From Lighthouse Project. Lighthouse.
Yeah, the connection isn't that great, so I just wanted to make sure that we got that. So, Lighthouse. Okay, so patreon.com/lighthouse. And how does Patreon work anyway? Because I don't know how it works. So I'm imagining a lot of the people listening don't know how it works either.
Well, you can go on there and create an account. And then ours is set up monthly. Some people, especially YouTube users, will say per video. The person pledges to pay, say, $1 per video or whatever they can afford.
Oh.
But we set it up by the month, and so you just choose your amount, and then there's different reward levels. So for just like $1 a month, then every month they get an update from me that summarizes all the stuff that we've accomplished and the cases we're working on. And then you get a personal message from somebody that we've helped for $5 a month. And then there's different reward levels, and the rewards are nice, but generally just people are, they're being very generous right now. Actually, we've been really lucky for how short a time it's been since we set it up, for how much support we're getting. But so it's a way you can just donate, like even just $1 a month to try and help these guys that we're helping. But also things like addressing this Bill C-51. I'm actually meeting with lawyers who agree how devastating this is, and we're trying to organize making submissions to the standing committee to try and stop this from going through.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's one of the scariest things when I watched one of your videos and you said that there was absolutely no one raising any kind of alarm about this horrible change to the law, except for one lawyer. And I remember the video that you did about that. And it's kind of scary to think that something as important as this can go by and none of the media is picking up on it or watching our rights dissolve in front of us and no one seems to care.
Well, defense lawyers have just been under so much attack over the last, 10 years or so. There's, feminist legal academics who regularly write articles attacking defense lawyers, sometimes by name. Elaine Craig out in Dalhousie, this is pretty much all she does. I saw her do a lecture, actually. She said that a couple of lawyers threatened to sue her over one of her articles. Oh, good. It's really vicious, and they put up with a lot of abuse, and maybe that's why they're trying to keep their heads down.
Mm-hmm.
But when this bill was announced on June 6th, a lot of people expected me to do a video on it straight away.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, no, I'm just going to wait and see what's going on, because there was a previous bill, 337, that says that all judges have to be educated in special before they can be appointed now.
Oh, yeah.
Educated in sexual assault by feminist groups. And the Canadian Judicial Council, the CJC, actually informed Parliament that they thought that that bill was unconstitutional because of the judicial independence problem, and just blew through. It's in the Senate now waiting to get approved.
Well, it just seems to me that because a lot of these problems come from, I call them radical feminists for want of not knowing the proper term, but it seems to me that they're acting as if they've been elected to represent women, whereas I haven't come across really more than one or two women in my entire entourage that really espouse any kind of views even close to radical feminism, and they won't go as far as the radical feminists go. And some of the horrible things they say about men, and they also seem to be forming a lobby group that the government is listening to. So these are unelected people pushing to have laws changed that really no one really wants changed. I'm sure if they stop and think about it for a minute, and if they have any kind of man in their life that they care about, they're not going to want these changes, or even themselves, because it's not impossible that this be turned.
If they understand the changes, which is what we have to. That's where we have to start, is to help people understand what these changes actually mean.
So
what you're talking about is, they're called the Charter Activists, right? So, and with the Radical Feminists, they've got this group called Women's Legal Education and Action Fund, in short form it's LEAF, and they go in and they basically, they're changing law through the courts instead of through the government, and they litigate and they intervene in appeal cases. And they've been slowly chipping away at all of the accused's rights, and especially in sexual assault. But LEAF only enters into Section 15 cases. That is the one that helped to get the wording the way they wanted it on it. But that's the one where you have equality, where you can't be discriminated against based on your gender, among other things, right? All those protected classes of people.
Uh-huh.
And as soon as that was passed, LEAF was formed and they started litigating. And it's, funded by, wealthy women. And the lawyers will volunteer their time to prepare the arguments for court. And it was extremely clever and extremely toxic.
Huh.
But my thought, this is kind of a revelation I had recently. I think really what's going on and why this seems strange to so many people. They don't really understand a lot of what the radical activists are talking about. It struck me that, and you mentioned Jordan Peterson earlier, he talks a lot about postmodernism.
Mm-hmm.
For anyone who doesn't know what that is, they should go look it up and actually watch Jordan Peterson videos on it. But postmodernism, this is the idea that all of reality is subjective, right? That there is no reality. And this is why they say the courts are oppressive and patriarchal, because the court, a trial is a fact-finding mission. When, according to a postmodernist, there is no fact to be found.
It's just feelings.
It's subjective. Right. And then, of course, when you mix that with their belief that whatever the woman, and they've got this in law, it's the woman's subjective opinion about whether or not she was violated in some way, the only thing that matters in terms of consent. And it doesn't matter what she was doing, or, you know, there's no implied consent allowed. So the woman is the one who's got 100% control over the subjective value of the experience. And so if they're saying it was sexual assault, there's no need for a fact-finding mission, because postmodernists don't believe in that reality. There's no actual facts to be found.
But none of them have any concern that this is going to come back and bite someone they love or themselves?
I mean, that's really what we try to get people to look at in terms of, you know, pushing these strange ideologies is,
yeah,
okay, let's say you get it, that, let's say you transform the world. Imagine yourself living in that world, and then imagine you're the one who's being accused.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Who would want to live in a world like that? I mean, if today it's about sexual assault, tomorrow it can be, well, actually, it's tomorrow is here, because it can be about hurting someone's feelings over their pronouns.
Mm-hmm. I know, and it's interesting, too, because they keep making, they being the academics who are arguing the philosophy of their proposals and so on, saying, oh, no, it would never result in, say, Jordan Peterson saying he'd end up in jail if he refuses to use them. Well, that's ridiculous, they say. And yet, we'll actually then see that threat being issued by those same people.
Oh, yes.
So,
yeah.
And I think that's one of the reasons I've gotten involved in this, too, is that there's so much fraud and so many lies being, you know, spouted off. And nobody's been willing to call it out. And I don't like being lied to.
No.
It really makes me angry.
Yeah, so I know what you mean.
That's kind of what got me speaking out. It's like, don't lie to me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, and also with advocates, too, when you ask them to explain things, they say it's not my job to educate you.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I was like, you know what? As an advocate, it actually is your job.
Mm-hmm.
But fine.
Yeah.
You want me to go look it up? You're going to regret that, because, of course, I'm really good with research. So then when I come back, they find themselves in a bit more trouble than they expected.
If they listen to you. The big thing right now is to not listen to someone who has a differing opinion. If someone's opinion doesn't match, then they're just going to shut you down and not listen to you.
And that's another problem, too, is what's being classified as violence. So
yeah.
We're entering a phase where words are actually deemed to be the equivalent of a violent act.
Yes. Yeah, and it's more scary all the time. Diana, thank you very much for being with us and talking with us today, and I hope you'll speak with us again, because it's...
Yeah, well, thank you for having me.
It's very important. I think a lot of people are going to be very surprised at what's going on with the legal system in Canada once they open their eyes. And we did talk a lot about Jan Gomeshi, but... the thing is, there are other people, and it's probably a bad example to use him because there was some, you know, but there are a whole host of people, mostly men, of course, being hurt by the laws that already exist, let alone the ones that are coming down the pipeline. It's Mr. Elliot, I forget his, he was an example, who came up against...
Gregory Allen Elliot?
Yes. Yeah. Had his life totally ruined. Yeah, had his life totally ruined, and is just barely getting back on his feet after 3 years, I think it was, of waiting to have his story heard before he could even come out.
Yeah, there's still a lot of questions in that case as to how that ended up in court.
Yeah.
There's a lot of important questions.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who I've read have been saying that they don't understand how it ever got to court or why it was that that this case was heard. And allowed to be heard at all.
Well, thankfully he got the right verdict on that. But yeah, he was barred from the internet for 2 years, and a lot of his work that he did was connected to the internet. So it's just been devastating for him and his family. Still not recovered from that.
No, and there's a lot of other people who have been hurt by these... these accusations, and with more of them coming. And the thing is, with any law that gets passed, someone is going to be accused of breaking it sooner or later. So they can talk about how it's not harmful and really and all that. But if you make a law, someone's going to be accused of breaking it. That's for sure. Otherwise, there's no point in making the law.
Right. And, you know, I do understand the sort of utopian thinking behind a lot of this, you know, so-called progress, and right? Why they think it's progress. There's some things that are really great ideas, like human rights. are really good ideas. Mm-hmm. But then you have to think about how you're going to actually apply them. How are you going to, go about determining, the boundaries or applying it in a codified way, right?
Yeah.
And there's another thing that people get a chance to look at. You should look at the difference between negative rights and positive rights. Negative rights, that's our civil liberties, basically. They're called negative because you're saying to the government, keep off my grass, keep out of my home without a proper warrant and without just cause, and respect all of my rights.
Mm-hmm.
And the positive rights are the ones where we're asking the government to do things for us, to intervene in our lives.
Hmm.
So saying that, we have a right to education. Well, we shouldn't be blocked from getting an education. But, this is a good idea. We want an educated society. But those are when you start getting into positive rights. And a lot of the charter activists, it's all based on positive rights. I have a right to respect. Well, yeah, you should be treated with respect. But how do you legislate that?
Ah, yeah. Yeah. Right? I don't think legislation ever works well with something like that. I think what works well is cultural pressure. If it's not culturally acceptable, then people won't do it.
So that's what we just have peer groups for.
Exactly, yes. Yeah, so Diana Davison, I strongly suggest that people look you up on YouTube. You've made, I don't know how many YouTube videos that are just fascinating to watch and listen to. Diana Davison, and there's no D in Davison. It's Davison, not Davidson. So if you even take a quick look on YouTube, I think you'll get hooked and want to find out more about what's happening right here in Canada, the land that's supposed to be free, but getting less so all the time. And really, it's not exaggerating to say that, I don't think.
It's the land of the ideologues now.
Unfortunately, yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.